It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we wrap up our series of interviews with candidates running in next Tuesday's special primary election in the 7th Congressional District. Today we'll hear from Jason Church, one of the Republicans on the ballot. First, Milwaukee may not be the biggest city in the Midwest, but its rock and roll scene has been putting its unique stamp on music since the 1950s. Now a new book highlights some of the musicians, venues, and DJs who made the city's music what it is. The editors of that book join us now in our Milwaukee studio. The book is called Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 to 2000, A Reflective History. Let's meet them now. David Lurson is managing editor of the Shepherd Express. He's written several books on history and punk rock. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Bruce Cole is librarian at Marquette University and curator of the school's Milwaukee Music Collection. He's been a drummer for more than 50 years. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And then Philip Naylor is a professor of history at Marquette. He introduced a course on rock and roll history there. Phil, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, Bruce, I want to start with you. You've got a unique perspective on rock and roll bands in Milwaukee history because reading the book, it seems like you were in just about all of them. Can you take us to the early days as a teenager? There's this new thing going on, rock and roll, and you wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, I was. I was part of it.
Yeah. Well, talk about your first experience in a rock and roll band in Milwaukee.
Okay, I saw my first experience with a rock and roll band, I think, was in 1963, and my sister's boyfriend actually had a friend who had a band, and it was just a little band with an accordion and a guitar, and their drummer had quit, and they needed a fill-in drummer, and I had two drums and some sticks, and so I filled in, and it was a lot of fun. But my first real band was in 1964, and I met some very important local players, and they helped me get into a band called the Grand Prix, and that was my first sort of real rock band.
Now, Dave, some cities have an identity or a sensibility that at least people claim runs through their music. There's been a lot of styles in Milwaukee that you guys write about in the book, but is there something that unites it all in your mind, Dave?
Well, I don't know about the style so much because there are so many different genres covered by Milwaukee rock musicians over the decades. Strong songwriting has been really prevalent here since at least the early 1970s. I would put some of the great songwriters of Milwaukee up against their counterparts in much bigger cities. But then there's this whole blue-collar ethic, which again is not maybe unique to Milwaukee. Maybe Cleveland was the same way. Maybe parts of Chicago were the same way. But this was a really hardworking town, and even if you were a kid rebelling against the older generation at that point, somehow you imbued this attitude. Maybe I'm not going to work in a factory like my father did, but I'm going to work really hard as a rock musician, and this is hard work. I mean, it's not just lounging around having fun all day. I mean, to make this work, gigging in clubs in an area like Milwaukee or through the Midwest, it's a lot of work and a lot of hard effort.
And Dave just mentioned the clubs, the venues, and Phil, their characters of their own in the book. What were some of the places that mattered in this history of Milwaukee rock music?
Well, you have Shank Hall today, but it used to be called Teddy's, which did a lot of blues in particular. You had Century Hall, which burned down, was another another important site. Zach's North Avenue was a particular favorite, particularly because Zach brought in blues, and also it was a punk headquarters. What was so great about all these sites is that you could get to meet and talk with the performers. What distinguishes Milwaukee rock, at least to me, is its accessibility to audiences, and also you just have just the talent itself was very, very impressive. So I'd have to say that those were just some of the clubs, and there were so many others. The Avant Garde, the Scene, major place downtown, which brought in great acts from all over the country, and for that matter, international acts. And the Cream, for example, played at the Scene.
Talking to the editors of the new book, Milwaukee Rock and Roll 1950 to 2000. Bruce Cole, David Lurison, and Philip Naylor are with us. You can join in, by the way, if you have a memory to share. 800-642-1234 is the number. Now, we've got a little taste of some of the music. You cover so many acts in the book. Let's give a listen to Sam McHugh. Bruce, I think you called him the fountainhead of rock and roll in Milwaukee. Here's a listen to his group, The Legends, and the song Say Mama from 1963. Bruce, can you talk about Sam McHugh's piece of the Milwaukee music history scene?
Yeah, I met Sam when I was about, actually around 12 or 13. The guy across the street, I grew up on 103rd and Greenfield, off of Greenfield, and he drove their truck around, and I got to drive around with him, and got to be good friends. They were really nice guys. Sam was a regular guy, and his drummer, Jim Cecity, actually got me into this first band. We were out where they play at Muskego Beach, and then I didn't have a band, and I was too young. And he told a friend of his that I was the best drummer in West Dallas. And so the guy hired me, and it worked out. And from then on, I kind of had my ticket punched, so to speak, because we played out at Muskego Beach about 10 times, and that was kind of the place to be. If you played out there, then everybody thought you were a big deal.
And Bruce, you write that in Milwaukee, you can divide rock up into before, during, and after the Beatles in this era. What was happening in Milwaukee in this, you know, as the Beatles hit? Did you see a lot of bands try to create that British invasion sound?
Yeah, I think it was the Beatles, and it was what was attracted to the Beatles, which was all these young girls, 10, 11, 12-year-old girls, who for the first time had money in their pocket and would go out and buy 45 RPM records, and that's what, you know, that's what sort of made the Beatles and the British Invasion as popular as it was. And then having all these young guys, 15, 14, 16, 20, baby boom guys, and they all wanted to jump on that train, and so all of a sudden you had these 135 bands around Milwaukee all doing Beatles songs and growing long hair and trying to look like their favorite Beatle.
And Phil, in this era too, a folk music scene, a folk rock around the country, what did we see in Milwaukee with that influence?
Well, you certainly have one person in particular who was the impresario of all of this, and that was Nicholas Topping. Nick Topping, remarkable individual who began acting as a kind of an impresario, organizing folk concerts, bringing in people like Pete Seeger, bringing in international artists, Mikis Theodorakis, the great Greek composer. He brought him in. He brought in Bob Dylan. That didn't work out too well because Dylan was not satisfied with the sound system. But just a wonderful individual, and that again, you know, characterizes Milwaukee. You have these wonderful people, kind of a confluence of not only musical talents, but of people who were interested in sharing what they knew about music with an audience. I see so many of these musicians and owners of clubs, for that matter, as being educators. Certainly FM radio playing an important role here, too, and just educating people about different kinds of music, different styles, genres, and all of that. And, you know, the folk scene was part of that. But, you know, to have Gene Ritchie here, to have Josh White, go on and on with some of the great names.
You mentioned radio. Part of the book is devoted to the city's radio personalities. I want to get a taste of one of them, Dr. Bop, an R&B DJ on WAWA out of Elm Grove.
I think it really should have been triplets. It's unfair for one man to be so tough. Bop be my name, music is my game, and WAWA is my claim to fame. And I'm that cat with a fine brown frame.
Dave, can you talk about the role of radio in the history of Milwaukee rock?
Well, we were very lucky during the 1970s when I was in high school to have two good FM rock stations, somewhat free form, WZMF and WQFM, and several notable DJs working in those areas came to work at those stations. Bob Reitman, of course, being the one we remember most. He's still on the air in Milwaukee, elsewhere. And, of course, they played largely, you know, national releases, but there was room in the programming at that time for some local releases. And there were albums being released by people in the 1970s here in Milwaukee, Sigmund Snopek, Jim Spencer, and other people. And they were getting a taste of airplay here. Gary Tannen, another example of that. So it was a flourishing environment. Also, we had an underground newspaper called the Bugle American that covered some of the local people. And I grew up thinking that Milwaukee was a place where things were happening and could happen, where creative people could find a platform or a microphone to sing through. And you didn't necessarily have to move out to New York or Los Angeles to make music or do something important. If you didn't want to, you could do it here.
We're talking to Dave Lurson, Bruce Cole, and Phil Naylor, editors of the book Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 through 2000, A Reflective History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What bands or musicians from the Milwaukee area do you remember, or maybe did you play in? Anyone you think should have gotten more credit beyond the city limits? Do you have memories of the scene in Milwaukee, a favorite venue? Did you play with these bands? You're still playing music out there. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Or if you have a question for our guests, you can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. More coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Bruce Cole, Phil Naylor, and Dave Lurson, editors of the book Milwaukee Rock and Roll 1950 to 2000, A Reflective History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have a question or a memory to share. We'll go to your calls now. Larry is with us in Marcusen. Larry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, when I was a teenager, 14, 15, 16, we used to see a lot of free concerts down in Grant Park in South Milwaukee. It was just awesome. Do you recall that at all?
Any of our guests want to jump in on Grant Park live music? Any memories there?
Well, the alternate site on the northern shore of the lake was a big deal in the 70s. Grant Park. I don't know about that. Anybody here know about Grant Park?
No takers? No, all right.
I think I played in Grant Park, but I can't remember.
Uh-oh. It must have been a heck of a show. Larry, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to get into the Milwaukee punk scene a little bit here. Dave, one of the bands you wrote about, we'll give a listen here, the Haskells from 1980, Taking the City by Storm. Dave, we talked about radio and the rock bands. Punk rock maybe had a tougher time getting on the air. How did they get the word out?
Word of mouth and posters and flyers. I got introduced to the Haskells. I was 17 years old, still in high school, writing for a very short-lived underground newspaper here in town, and went to their house on the east side and just sort of, you know, fell into the scene. I mean, they seemed like authentic, creative people with a little bit of a different take on music and where music might be going. I mean, the enormous wealth of songwriting within that band, with two very distinct songwriters, Jerome Bridge and Richard Lavallier, working different ends of the spectrum. So, radio was not helpful at that moment. In a couple of years, though, college radio station, which became WMSE, became important in promoting newer forms of music of all kinds internationally, but also they kept a close ear to the ground here in Milwaukee.
We heard from Luann in Germantown, who says that there was a place, the Attic in downtown Milwaukee. Yes. I'm sorry, I've got to look at my screen here. They had some good gigs. She saw the Everly Brothers there, and people got to meet them backstage. So there's that access, Phil. Milwaukee, maybe the distance between the stars and the fans wasn't as big as it might have been elsewhere.
And, you know, speaking about the Everly Brothers, again, you have that Milwaukee connection because Sam McHugh toured with them. He was their guitarist. And
20 years.
That was how many years? For 20 years, Bruce said. So, yeah, you had that access. For example, Muddy Waters was at Zach's North Avenue for about 5 nights or so. And this is just unbelievable to have, you know, to have this great blues man here for that long of a time. And you could after a set, he'd come and talk. You could talk with them. You could just basically become acquainted. And I described this to a friend of mine as being, you know, for me being about the same as, you know, meeting an important statesman of Europe. And the guy was just so famous and so important, and to have him so accessible. And again, you have this great confluence of great musicians in so many different genres. And the three of us believe basically that had to be, you know, certainly recognized. And it was recognized by a lot of people, but in some ways it had to be archived. So that's what we did.
Let's bring on another caller now. Carol is with us in Oak Creek. Carol, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, do you have a chapter on Milwaukee women rock musicians? I know back in the day there was like the GTOs and Ruby Star, and I was just wondering if you covered other women musicians.
Well, before we get an answer, by coincidence, we have a clip from Ruby Star referenced in the chapter that does exist in the book. Here's Ruby Star with the band Grey Ghost and a song Burnin' Whiskey from 1975.
Seems you had it with all of my games. Trouble in hard times come with my name.
I know another author had written the Women in Music chapter. Just wondering, you want to talk about women in the Milwaukee rock scene a little bit?
Well, yeah, the person who did that chapter, Rose Trupiano, has been a great advocate of women and rock, and we were really happy to have her included in the book itself. But it was important to have women in it because rock has this image occasionally of being very patriarchal, and we wanted to address that. And we discovered, at least, of course, well, Rose knew about this, and she shared this information with us about some really, great people. Sue DeBacco from Chicago, for example, who's in the chapter, got to talk with her a few times, and just a tremendous blues rocker. And again, these are people who needed to be recognized, and we tried to do that.
Thanks for that call. We'll bring on Kitty now in Glendale. Kitty, hello. Kitty, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, go for it, Kitty. Yeah. What did you want to tell us about?
Okay, I used to go to Muskego Beach in the day and heard them out there, and the song by the Legends, I used to hear them out at the old house. So I'm enjoying the show, and keep it going.
Kitty, thanks a lot for the call. You know, it seems like, do you guys run into people where you tell them you're working on this rock and roll book and they have their memory of the show or the place or the scene that they used to be part of?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, when this young lady mentioned the old house, mm-hmm. there was it used to be out on what they call the Ozaukee Beer Run when northern Wisconsin outside of Milwaukee was an 18-year-old world of
teen bars,
and that with Weiler's, the old house, those were really, really wild places. You know, it was just sort of because 18-year-old meant also that you'd have 16-year-olds in there with fake IDs, and unfortunately there were a lot of accidents coming in and out of those bars on the way back and forth from Milwaukee.
So that was, I think there was a stretch in the book you mentioned drinking age in Milwaukee was 21 for spirits, it was 18 out of town?
Yes, all over, as soon as it became 18 all around northern Wisconsin, just outside, all of a sudden there were every roadhouse in Wisconsin outside of up north became a teen bar, and you could play these places six nights a week, and that was a lot of work because I remember spending a summer going when I was 16 playing teen bars from Eau Claire to Superior to Green Bay to Appleton to Nina, Manitowoc, all over the place, five, six nights a week. And I was, I think I was 16 at the time, and I came back and bought a brand new car. I was the only kid in high school with a brand new car.
Now, I know your book goes up to 2,000, but I really want to get to hear from each of you if there's a local or area act that you're following nowadays or maybe playing in nowadays. Let's start with you, Bruce.
Well, the act I'm following is the act I play with right now called the Doo-Wop Daddies, and it's probably the most fun band I've ever been in. It's seven people, and they do doo-wop. They do music from the 50s and very early 60s, and the vocals are just absolutely terrific, and it's a show.
Phil, how about you?
Well, I actually continue to explore some of the talent that has traditionally been here, like Paul Sebar and Sigmund Snopek. People like that continually interest me, and in part because of their explorations.
And Dave, your modern-day Milwaukee favorites.
I don't want to single any one or two groups out, but I'm pleasantly surprised in recent years of an upsurge of some of what we've been talking about here. Quality songwriting, high energy, reinventing the essence of rock and roll for a new era. It's still happening here in Milwaukee.
And Dave, I want to give you the last word. The title is A Reflective History, not The History of Milwaukee Music. You cover a lot, but there's more. Other people have different perspectives. That was kind of an important point to you. This is not the definitive thing.
Well, I'm against any author who writes the history of Great Britain or the history of the United States or whatever it may be, because there are many histories. And we made the honest attempt in the book to try to represent a number of voices and perspectives. There's room for a second revised, expanded edition.
We'll look forward to that. Thank you all so much for joining us today. It's been a lot
Thank
of fun.
You. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Been talking to David Lurson, Bruce Cole, and Philip Naylor. They join us in our studio in Milwaukee. They are editors of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 to 2000, A Reflective History. Our series of conversations with candidates in the special election for the 7th Congressional District wraps up today ahead of next Tuesday's primary vote. That district spans 20 counties across northern and central Wisconsin. The decision from voters there next Tuesday will determine who advances to the special general election in May. Jason Church is a retired Army captain and Afghanistan war veteran. He's running as a Republican in that race. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
What is your before we get into issues, what's your basic pitch to voters to vote for you on Tuesday?
I never wanted to be in politics. I wanted to have a career in the military. That's how I wanted to serve our nation. But after I was injured in Afghanistan and lost my legs, I couldn't serve in the way that I had wanted to since I was 5 years old. But I'll tell you this, even though the Taliban took my legs, America's enemies didn't extinguish my desire to serve. It's still there. It still burns in me. And there are things right now that need leadership in Washington that come from outside of politics. And my experience on the battlefield and making life or death decisions will, I think, make a big difference in the swamp or the beltway.
Let's start now with the economy. What do you see as some of the biggest economic challenges facing the 7th Congressional District?
Well, first, let's look at some of the things that have gone well economically. Obviously, the Trump administration, we have had record low unemployment. Wages have gone up, and there are a lot of things that attribute to that. One has been the tax cuts and deregulation that has occurred with the Trump administration. And one thing that I would like to work on, certainly with the president in Washington, would be fostering more trade deals like the USMCA. This deal should have been done, in my opinion, a year ago. The fact that it was held up in the House for as long as it was, to me, signified more of a political ploy instead of thinking about the men and women who really not only work and create but also consume here in the United States. I'd like to work not only on more deals like that, but certainly obviously we have the UK leaving the EU, and that's a new trade deal that will need to be worked on. And I'd like to see other areas that would certainly be really looking forward to receiving American products and working on deals with the president to make that happen.
We've heard concerns in recent years about the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, in particular a lot of bankruptcies, farm bankruptcies over the years. Do you see specific policy solutions that could help out dairy farmers in your district and around the state?
We have some of the best products in the world produced here in Wisconsin and some of the best dairy products known anywhere. And obviously the USMCA had part of the solution here. The Canadians for the longest time were basically, you know, subsidizing their milk pricing, subsidizing their milk industry in general. And the new agreement allows us to actually be able to not only export more there, but also make the just the actual trade and transaction more fair. I think we need to do more of that. I think there is markets around the world that want that, and I would like to work with the president on being able to provide him with not only the basis of some of these trade deals, but work with him hand in hand on it.
We asked our listeners to provide questions for candidates on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Marianne gave us one of our questions. We've been running past the candidates. Marianne wants to know if you'll protect people, she says, with pre-existing conditions in the healthcare system.
I think that's something that we have talked about time and time again. The president has talked about with pre-existing conditions. This is something that's very important. And I think that the current healthcare system, as it is designed right now, is really it's not working, and part of it is because the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, if you will, has basically slammed on regulations, slammed on basically higher deductibles, higher premiums, and is pushing people out of the market. When you look at northern Wisconsin, when you look at what we have here, we have Marshfield Clinic, which has been an innovator in rural medicine. And right now, they want to be able to provide more services throughout northern Wisconsin. But because of regulations from the federal government that really limit the ability for telecommunication with a provider, they are limited in what they can offer. And it's hard for people to drive, you know, the hours and hours, you know, if you're going from northern Wisconsin, if you're going from Tomahawk and trying to come down to Marshfield, from getting the care that they need. We need more price transparency, and we also need to be able to have health insurance sold across state lines, because right now everything that's set up in the system right now from regulation inflates cost and reduces efficiency of care.
Talking to Jason Church, one of the two Republican candidates in the primary race for the 7th Congressional District. Peggy on Facebook wrote, do you support term limits for all politicians?
I am a firm supporter of term limits. I have said throughout my campaign that I pledge to serve no more than 4 terms or 8 years. And I think part of the problem in Washington right now is we've had too many people who have been trying to move up the ladder to get into higher office and then sit there, and then they make political decisions, not decisions based on what the constituents need. And we have people there for decades and decades, and this is Republicans and Democrats. So I would be a firm proponent of putting a bill, if you know I could get some colleagues to sign along with it, to propose term limits on the floor. And what I think that would do is it would force members of Congress to bring a yay or nay vote, and regardless of the outcome, if they vote no, they have to go back to their constituencies and justify that. There has to be a process that's started, and as a congressman, that's something that I not only firmly believe in but want to help implement.
Do you see areas in Congress where you could see yourself working across the aisle and getting things done with Democrats in Congress?
There are a couple areas. I mean, obviously China right now is a growing threat. What they are doing, what they have done really in trade over the last 2 decades has been quite frankly, theft. I mean, when you look at what they've done with intellectual property and stealing it from American companies, creating mere organizations to price out American manufacturers, really since they've been admitted to the World Trade Organization, they have done this, and they've enriched themselves. They've created really a large, large industrial base that is now going to be able to put more resources into their military, which they are now using to really push pressure on their neighbors. The original islands that have been built in the South China Sea, they said was for scientific purposes. They have airstrips on there. They have military equipment on there. They are trying to expand their force. They are using Huawei, a telecom provider, which recently we've seen reports that they have backdoor ways into the hardware to allow the Communist Party to really infiltrate even a Western network like one in Britain. These are things, and what China's doing is something that both parties see as a problem right now. Obviously, it's not something that's being talked about a lot in the news, but I can tell you there are both Republicans and Democrats who see what China's doing as a major problem. The other one I will say is also infrastructure. This was something that a lot of people hoped could have been done in the last year or two, but obviously politics became way more of a focus than sound policy. But you know, our infrastructure in this country is at a low rate right now. And to be able to invest in that, there are certainly Republicans and Democrats on board with that. Now, coming from northern Wisconsin, I'm going to certainly push for more of that to be here and come home. Obviously, we have some issues with our infrastructure up here that need to be addressed. But I know that's an area where both Republicans and Democrats see a need.
We heard from Craig on Facebook, who asks what actions you would take to help prepare us for and to combat against climate change.
Well, let's look at a couple things. Number one, the carbon emissions in the United States have gone down over the last 10 years, and the Trump administration has taken the proper steps on that. The Paris climate deal, which to me, with the signatories on there, was not going to do a darn thing, and President Trump was right to pull out of it. When I see the things that are going on right now, no one wants to pollute our rivers. No one wants to tear down our forests. We have some of the best and most pristine land in the world here in northern Wisconsin. We want to protect that. But I will tell you that that doesn't happen from burdensome feel-good regulation that stymies growth, that stymies innovation. And to be quite frank with you, I think this administration has done more than previous in this matter.
A lot of people have said you and your primary opponent agree on a lot of issues, a lot of the key issues. How would you distinguish yourself from Tom Tiffany on Election Day?
I'm not someone who's trying to move up the ladder in politics. I never saw myself doing this. For me, I wanted to serve our country in uniform. But after I was injured, I couldn't do that anymore. But I still want to serve and give back. And I can tell you this. This district cannot have just another rubber stamp vote. It needs a fighter. And I will be the conservative warrior that we need here in the 7th Congressional District to represent us and sometimes kick down doors if necessary. The thing is, when the coasts of this country get ideas, they sometimes look at us as flyover country, and they love to pass us over. And I can tell you in Congress that that will never happen to this district.
As we wrap up day one, if you're elected, what is your top priority?
Top priority day one, well, at this point, we need to be able to make sure that the NDAA goes through. We need to make sure that we have the things to make sure our military is funded. To me, that is a top priority of the federal budget every year when it comes to discretionary spending. I would also like to start looking at ways of really strengthening trade deals. Obviously, I talked about that a little bit earlier in the program, but I'd like to make sure to work with the White House to ensure that our manufacturers and farmers are taken care of and make sure that we have fair and reciprocal deals.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jason Church, retired Army captain and Afghanistan war veteran. He's running as a Republican in the special primary race for the 7th Congressional District next Tuesday. We extended an invitation to Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany, who's also running in that primary on Tuesday. His campaign declined to participate. To catch up on any candidate interviews you may have missed, go to WPR.org and click on the politics link in the news tab. The number of drug overdose deaths in Milwaukee County is on the rise. According to the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner, there were 407 confirmed overdose deaths in 2019. They announced via their official Twitter account that the number is likely to grow as cases wait for results from toxicology testing. The overdose deaths are largely linked to opioids, including fentanyl and heroin. Our next guest joins us to talk about the rise in cases and what initiatives are underway to try to bring that number down. Alderman Michael Murphy represents Milwaukee's 10th District on the city's Common Council. He's also chair of the City-County Heroin, Opioid, and Cocaine Task Force. Alderman Murphy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, what are your thoughts, first of all, on this news, this number of overdose deaths going up last year in Milwaukee County?
Well, it's really disheartening. We had seen a bit of a drop in 2018, but we've seen a significant increase now, unfortunately, in this last year. The biggest rise has been with fentanyl and carfentanyl derivatives, which have caused a substantial rise in that category. In addition, the issue of cocaine deaths have risen significantly over the last several years. Of course, that's mixed with a cocktail of drugs. So it's a huge challenge for our county, and we're trying to make a change in that paradigm. And we have some initiatives that are just starting out in the last 6 months, and so far they're having some preliminary success, but we have a long ways to go.
A lot of times in the conversation about opioids in particular, there's been a focus on rural and small town America, and some people saying, hey, wait a minute, there is a problem in cities too, don't overlook this. Do you think that we've kind of taking the eye off the ball nationally when it comes to overdoses in urban areas?
I think we took our eye off the ball nationally, both rural and urban areas, as it relates to the issue of drug overdose deaths. We're starting to see some effort to provide additional resources to communities, both rural communities and cities. But when you think of the fact that more people died in last year in the United States through overdose deaths by nearly 20-some thousand people than all of the Vietnam War, it shows you the scope of the problem facing all of us.
We started to see a big problem with things like oxycodone and other medications mm-hmm. that might have been prescribed legally in the first place and maybe found their way into the wrong hands. It sounds like from what you're saying, the problem in Milwaukee right now, as elsewhere, is things that were straight up illegal from the start. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, a lot of people got hooked on a legal narcotic, oxycodone, and then subsequently the drugs have been pulled back from the pill doctors. Then people moved to street drugs. And unfortunately, what we've seen, people move to heroin, and then the fentanyl became a big part of the equation and carfentanil. And now cocaine is making a big rise also. So the reality is how it's a moving target. But at the end of the day, finding additional resources to provide comprehensive treatment, education and prevention, those type of things need to be instituted both rural and citywide.
Before we get into the efforts that you are working on in Milwaukee to turn this around, is it, from what you're hearing from the public health people, is it a case that more people are using these drugs or that more lethal versions of the drugs, and I'm thinking of things like fentanyl here, are more prevalent in the market?
I think what we've seen, when you look at the statistics, fentanyl has been the huge factor in a lot of these deaths. If you go back just to 2014, we had 16 people die fentanyl-related. This year alone, it's 238 in 2019. So I'll show you how much fentanyl has played a big role in increasing the number of deaths. And obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about where that drug is coming from, many respects being manufactured in China and coming through the borders. But it's had a devastating impact.
Talking to Alderman Michael Murphy from Milwaukee, chair of the City County Heroin, Opioid, and Cocaine Task Force, looking at a rise last year in deaths due to overdose. You mentioned, Alderman Murphy, new initiatives over the last 6 months. What kind of things are you talking about?
Well, we created a new program called Milwaukee Overdose Response Initiative, where we have caseworkers working with our paramedics to respond to overdose calls, where they get to the scene and they administer Narcan, Naloxone, and they basically bring a person back to life. In the past, we just gave them a 3x5 business card and said, here's, call this number if you need help. The peer counselor now works very closely with this individual and their families to get them into treatment and get them into treatment that very day. We have places that are now open and reserved for them to get them into help. So in the last 6 months, we've gotten 39 people who, quite honestly, would not be around today are now in treatment and getting help. So we hope that program, we recently were awarded a large grant from the Center for Disease Control because of our early success. So we've expanded that program now to 6 days a week, 8 hours a day. In addition, we're going into parks, working with individuals on harm reduction strategies. You know, we're working from many different perspectives, working with community groups, individuals, and like I indicated, with the fire department and the health department and healthcare providers to try and change the paradigm that we've seen in the last several years.
Addiction treatment, as I understand it, can be a long-term process. Are there resources available, enough resources available to provide longer-term treatment for that person, as you say, who might have just been resuscitated from Narcan and you're trying to get them off of that addiction in the long run?
I would say there's not enough resources. For example, we did receive this grant of $750,000, and I have great hope for it. But when you look at the scope of the problem, you would hope there would be additional financing coming through. Mike Lapham from the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Services is doing an outstanding job there, but the resources that he has to work with getting individuals into treatment, whether it's an Oxford House Clean Slate or other providers, he needs additional funding. The problem is it hasn't been there in the last several years. We're starting to see some of the money kind of trickle down from the state. But when you look at the scope of the problem, I always think if this was Zika virus or coronavirus, we would have a lot more financial resources. But because of the stigma associated with drug addiction, the money has really not been coming through. And, of course, that's why one of the reasons the city has began joined in the lawsuit going after the pharmaceutical companies who played a big role in why we have this addiction problem in our country.
That's the treatment side of things. Are there changes or efforts needed on the law enforcement side of things to try to slow the supply of these potentially fatal drugs?
Yeah, I mean, we have a HIDA law enforcement agency here in Milwaukee. It works very collaboratively with the DEA, the sheriff's office, the police department, and they've made some large seizures of drugs coming into the country. But, you know, it's a supply and demand issue. And we hear, you know, the cartels are making tons of money off this, and they're more than happy to figure out a way to get the drugs here. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to arrest our way out of the problem. I really don't think that's going to be the ultimate solution. It really has to be a comprehensive one, looking at trying to prevention, education, treatment, and certainly law enforcement, but it can't be just one pillar of that three-legged stool.
Now, you mentioned cocaine, and we hear a lot about opioid deaths. Can you talk about how that cocaine has another category of drug has factored into this overdose death situation?
Yeah, and cocaine, you know, it's different from affecting your receptors. Obviously, with opiates, you basically lose your breath and your lungs and capacity. And, of course, with cocaine, it's an accelerant. So the problem is the drug dealers are telling individuals who are using heroin, you know, move to cocaine. It's not as deadly. What they're not telling them is that they're still mixing it with fentanyl. And then you have that lethal dose, and that's resulting in such a large, stark increase. The big fear that we hear coming down is, you know, we know in northern Wisconsin, parts of our state where meth has had a huge inroad, we're fearful about that coming to our city. And that would be another drug we'll have to worry about. So the law enforcement are very much on top of that and trying to stop that getting into our city.
Do you see, amidst this bad news from last year, hopeful signs that with the efforts you talked about already, you can turn this around?
You know, I have to have hope. I've talked to a lot of parents. People have lost their brothers and sisters and all crosses of society, and you have to have hope. It just can be very daunting when these are not numbers to me. These are real live people, and I've met some of the families, and it has a devastating impact on them for the rest of their lives. So I do have hope. Like I said, this new pilot program we've started in the south side of Milwaukee has gotten 39 people into treatment, and hopefully those 39 people stay in treatment and have long, productive lives. And I think that's what we have to focus on, and one person at a time, and try and change this outcome.
It seems like there was a slow response nationwide. It was a slow burn to see how bad this opioid problem is going to be. Do you feel like, as you're working with colleagues in the city and the county, that there is this sense of urgency, this all-hands-on-deck approach?
I do. I think I see a great deal of cooperation, and that's involving all different levels of law enforcement, healthcare providers, public officials, across different political boundaries. I think people all recognize we have to do more than what we're currently doing, but there still is a large amount of stigma out there about drug addiction. People still keep it in the closet, are ashamed to talk about it. It's a brain disease, and we should treat it as such.
Alderman Murphy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Alderman Michael Murphy. He represents Milwaukee's 10th District on the city's Common Council. He's also chair of the City-County Heroin, Opioid, and Cocaine Task Force. He joins us today to talk about the rise in drug overdose deaths in Milwaukee County, a record number last year in 2019, after the numbers had gone down a bit in 2018. What are you seeing in your community when it comes to the risk, the threat of death by overdose? Let us know what's going on in your part of the state. You can email ideas@WPR.org. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wisconsin bakers, here's an opportunity for you. The Great American Baking Show, a spinoff of the Great British Baking Show, is looking for amateur bakers for their new season. No professional training allowed. They're recruiting in Wisconsin right now, apparently, in the Madison area. I'm not sure how wide an area they mean. I'm sure you can get in on it, I hope. Jay Carlisle Larson is a fan of the show. Hey, JC.
Hello.
Now, you watch this. I've watched it some. My family loves it. I watch with them. You like it. You're a fan.
I do. I like it a lot because it is just the right amount of stressful to keep me engaged, but not stressful enough where I need to turn it off and cry in the shower or anything like that.
Right. A lot of these reality competition type shows, everybody's really mean. And yeah. It seems like they're, most people are pretty nice on this.
Yeah, everyone's nice. Everyone helps each other. Everyone kind of stops to have like a tea as they're waiting for things. It's like,
chill.
I wouldn't call it relaxing necessarily because there is a lot of pressure on the show. But it's not like you're watching them spear fish all day, I don't know, on Survivor. I haven't seen Survivor in like 15 years.
I think they still do that.
I don't know if they do.
Has it inspired you to bake anything yourself?
It makes me feel like I could be a very good baker. Uh-huh. I know that I'm an okay baker, but it does kind of get me like into the kitchen, but not enough to really follow through.
Well, you can audition by baking at home, JC, and bring it in for your Central Time
coworkers. Okay, sounds good.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.